SBS Radio.
Professor Akcham, welcome to Australia and welcome to SBS Radio's Armenian program.
Thank you very much.
Professor Akcham, could you talk a bit about yourself, your education, career and your interest?
Oh, it is a long topic actually. I cannot finish because I have several lives behind me. I graduated from Middle East Technical University, Ankara. I was very active in students' movement in 1970s. And I was also editor of a youth journal. The name of the journal was Revolutionary Youth. And I was a member of the 68th generation, what we call in Turkey. And I was arrested because of the articles that I published in this journal. Basically, topics were the social issues of Turkey, democracy, human rights, social injustices, and the Kurdish question. I have to underline that there was nothing on Armenian genocide, and I had no idea during that period of my life on Armenian genocide. And I was arrested and sentenced to 10-year imprisonment because of the article that I published in this journal. After 1 year, I escaped from prison and ended up in Germany as political asylum. I got the political asylum from Germany, and then I continued my political life until 1986. I arrived in Germany in 1977. So after 9 years of political activities, I then started again to study, and I started working at an institute in Hamburg, Hamburg Institute for Social Research. And then my first topic was the history of violence and political culture in Ottoman Turkish society. And this is how I got acquainted, or how I got to know the Armenian genocide, and I started working this topic. So this is the very short my background and how I got interested into the topic of Armenian genocide. So when I started, I was naive a little bit, as any other common Turkish intellectual. I didn't know much, or I didn't know anything on Armenian genocide. And I started working on this topic basically from an academic interest, from an intellectual interest. My first project ended after 3 years, and it was 1990, and I decided to go on with the second project, and I suggested to my institute working on the military tribunal in Istanbul. And then the institute accepted my project, and which turned later into my PhD, which is now published also in English language. It is available. I mean, the title of the book is A Shameful Act.
Professor Akcam, let's talk about your latest book on the trials in Istanbul. Could you talk about the book, the research you did, and the topic?
Actually, the book on the trial that I published with Dadrian, we were both authors of that book. It is not my latest book. My latest book is Young Turks, Crime Against Humanity, Armenian Genocide and Ethnic Cleansing in the Late Ottoman Empire. But it is true, the book before this, my latest book, was on the military tribunals in Istanbul. We published, Dadrian and myself, we published the verdicts and indictments of 13 trials in Istanbul. And this is a very important contribution to genocide research. We published this book first in Turkish language in 2009 or 2010, I cannot remember now. And in Turkish version, we published also approximately 14 sessions of the tribunals in Istanbul. But in English, we only published verdicts and indictments of these trials. It is a very important source for Armenian genocide because the court records includes the evidence, the testimonies of the defendants, the testimonies of eyewitness accounts, and also some other documents from high government officials, which clearly shows the genocidal intent of the Ottoman authority. The other important part of the book is that we showed that during these trials, there were a lot of Turkish eyewitnesses. So the Turkish individuals, the Ottoman Turkish Muslim individuals, they testified in the court against the perpetrators of Armenian genocide. In some cases, even the court decision basically relied on, based on these witness testimonies.
Professor Akçam, were there at the time international laws that the allies could use to try Turkish officials, or the convicted people were tried under Ottoman law?
During the Paris peace talks, 1919-1920, the Allied power tried to develop an international legal form, an international legal platform to try the perpetrators or the members of governments, but it failed. So the entire trials in Istanbul based on national legal Ottoman laws.
Aram Andonian's and Naim Bey's book and Talat Pasha's telegrams, have you studied them? Did the government use coded telegrams to give orders?
I can say several things for that topic. Number one, of course, I know the Andonian's book with Naim Bey, and I also know that the authenticity of these documents are disputed. Number one, as an answer to your question, we know that the Ottoman authorities used coded telegrams. In my latest book, Young Turks, Crime Against Humanity, I published more than 600 coded Ottoman telegrams. So Ottoman authorities used coded ciphers, telegrams from Istanbul, but we have to know that these channels, the coded telegrams sent through the channels of Interior Ministry, you cannot find the smoking guns in the documents, in the ciphered documents, because of very simple reason. We know today that Talat, the Interior Minister, used his house as a second telegraph office. He sent telegrams from his house, private telegrams to the governors. Where and how we know these? In 2010, a Turkish journalist, Murat Bardakçı, published an interview with Talat Pasha's wife. And the interview was conducted in 1982 or 83, and Murat Bardakçı published this interview in 2010. In this interview, Talat's wife personally confessed that Talat was organizing and coordinating the Armenian deportation, what she calls, from his house. Sometimes he was calling some officers from Interior Ministry, and these individuals were working through the nights and coordinating the Armenian genocide. I assume, that more incriminating documents were sent from Talat's house, not as official telegrams, but through these private channels as private telegrams. So regarding Andonian documents, I would like to say the following. I think it is necessary to take a second look to these documents. And I found similar documents which Andonian published in Ottoman archive also. These are not incriminatory documents, but, for example, documents related to Armenian workers on the railroad in Adana, and some similar documents related to, for example, Baron Hotel in Aleppo during that time. So we have some documents either have the same content as the Andonian documents or gives the same information what Andonian mentions to us. So from that perspective, I think it's very important to have a second look in the book and in these documents.
Is it possible to decipher the coded telegrams?
Not today, because they use a special cipher system, and we don't know whereabouts of these ciphers. What I published in my book is we can see, for example, in some telegrams, you see the ciphers, and on top of the ciphers, you see that the officers, the responsible guy, deciphered these and wrote the letters corresponding these ciphers on the same documents. So it is another very important proof that they used a certain coded system, and these codes or the cipher system were sent by regular mail to the provinces and then deciphered based on the key that they had in their hands.
Professor Akçam, a question about language. Ottoman Turkish is different from modern Turkish. Do you have to study specifically Ottoman Turkish, or knowing Turkish and Arabic alphabet, it is easy to read Ottoman books or documents?
If one knows the Arabic alphabet and knows Turkish, can read Ottoman. Unfortunately, I have to add also, most of the Ottoman documents in the Istanbul archive are handwritten documents. So it is not enough to read, to be able to read the printed materials. You have to develop a special skill to read these handwritten documents. And there are enough experts in Turkey who can read, and you can learn these handwritten Ottomans also. And if you know the Arabic language, it is a good start and doesn't take much time. But for an ordinary citizen, it is really a very painful process. Knowing Turkish is not enough, because Ottoman language of the time was a mix of Arabic and Persian words, so you need really a dictionary also. And you also should be able to read the handwritten materials. So the handwritten of each and every Ottoman officers, bureaucrats, of course, were different than the others. So you have to develop a special skill to read these materials.
Professor Akçam, about 10 years ago, I did my thesis on the Australian press. I would have also liked to have studied and compared the Australian press reports with Ottoman newspapers, but I haven't seen any, and also there is the language barrier. Have you studied the Ottoman press of World War I? Did they write what was happening? Was there censorship like in Allied countries or in Australia?
Of course, there was a censorship. And that regard, you can hardly find anything in Ottoman press of 1915-16. But the Ottoman press of 1919, 1920 until 1922 is totally different. My book, or our book with Dadrian, based on also on the Ottoman newspapers of the period of 1919-1922. There was no censor. There was a censorship of Allied power, but it was not a very important censor. So the newspapers, beginning 1918 November, until the Turkish nationalists took over the Istanbul, which is 1922 November, Turkish newspapers in Istanbul extensively reported from the events on the genocide. And the trial records, for example, mostly available in Turkish daily newspapers. In our book, Dadrian and myself, we showed that in Istanbul there were more than 60 trials, cases against Union and Progress Party. And this was basically impossible for us because we could read the Ottoman press, and we took this information from the Ottoman press. And the Armenian press of the time also reported extensively. Unfortunately, nobody worked on the Armenian press also. And these are Armenian newspapers are also available in Vienna, for example. And sometimes Armenian reporters went to the court and they reported directly as their own observations, or sometimes they also took from the Turkish newspapers and reprint the information in Turkish newspapers. So the period of 1919-1922 worth it to look into it, basically for Ottoman press and for Armenian press.
Professor Akçam, another subject I'm interested in studying is the fate of Armenian conscripted soldiers in the Ottoman army during the genocide. Is the subject studied properly? Are there any archival materials still left?
Number one, it hasn't been studied properly. Number two, it is very difficult to work on that topic because the main archive on that subject is the military archive. And military archive in Ankara is close to the researchers. So it is not possible to write a proper history of Armenian soldiers in the Ottoman army. Nevertheless, there are enough materials and somebody must really work on that topic. I'm not so sure whether you can follow from Australia the recent debates in Turkey. Very close friend of mine, professor of sociology, Ayhan Akhtar, have translated memoir of an Armenian officer, Torosyan, who wrote his memoirs when he came back to United States. Torosyan's memoirs was published 1948, and nobody was aware of this memoir, of this book. And we now have a Turkish translation of this book. And the interesting part of the memoir is that Torosyan was a soldier, an artillery officer in Dardanelles War, 1915. And he claims that he even was responsible or he was in charge of sinking one of the Allied powers' warship. And later, Torosyan learns that his family from Kayseri, and his family were deported, even though there were an order of the defense ministry that the soldiers' families should not be deported. And learning that his family were sent to deportation and killed on their ways, Torosyan deserted the army and participated first in the Arab uprising against the Ottoman government, and then he became a volunteer in the French Armenian Legion. And then he came back to United States and wrote these memoirs down. Now, because of these Torosyan memoirs, we learned that there are other Armenian soldiers in Dardanelles, in Gallipoli, and it is a very important topic, and nobody knows the story of these soldiers. We believe, really, that the entire body of Ottoman Christian soldiers were put together in labor battalions and exterminated, but I have some Ottoman materials from 1917-1918 that shows clearly, even in 1917-18, there were some Ottoman Armenian soldiers in the army, and they were discharged after when their service was over. So it is a very important topic, and somebody must work on this issue. I only know that there is an Armenian book published by a scholar, but it is not enough at this moment. We need really more research in that topic.
Professor Akçam, while doing my research, I found several articles which cover this topic, especially one who describes how in 1915 Armenian soldiers were forced to march from Constantinople to Gallipoli and then ordered to attack the Anzac soldiers. After the attack, most lost their lives, while few reached the Australian trenches and surrendered.
It is very important to know all this information. I know from some of my Armenian friends whose grandparents happened to be the Ottoman soldiers in the army. And for example, one of these friends told me the story of his grandfather saying that in Gallipoli, Ottoman authorities pushed the Armenian soldier in front, and they, this was a way of exterminating them also on the front. So this is, in that sense, very important for us, and we have to find more information in that regard, what happened really with the Ottoman Armenian soldiers.
Professor Akçam, what are the implications of the book published by Cemal Pasha's grandson, Hasan Cemal?
It is another important step towards facing history. It is another important step towards understanding our past and acknowledging historic wrongdoing. I think what Hasan did was a tremendous step, a courageous step, and there are now discussions going on, debates going on. People are writing their views on that book. It is, as I said, one of the other important steps of Turkish civil society to learn what really happened in 1915.
Professor Akçam, what's your opinion on Armenian diaspora's campaign in foreign parliaments to recognize the Armenian genocide? Is it helpful to keep the pressure on Turkish government? Hrant Dink, during his regular talks to our radio program, always said the key is the change within Turkish society.
Yes and no. I think I was thinking in the same way at the beginning of my dealing with the Armenian genocide. I was very reluctant regarding the parliament's resolution, and I also believed that the real change would come from inside of Turkey. But I think we should acknowledge another fact, another reality, which I know Hrant was acknowledging also. I remember vividly a discussion with Hrant in 2007, 1 week before his assassination. And during those days, it was again French Parliament, and the discussion was again the recognition of Armenian genocide by French government. And in our discussion, I had the argument that it was because of these pressures also, and sometimes especially because of these pressures, Turkey had to deal with topic. With this topic. Otherwise, Turkey tried to push this topic into silence. Turkey never wants to deal with this subject. And even though it has some negative aspect, maybe, that it increased the Turkish nationalism or the Turks got upset and so on, but we have to see the positive side also. Through this pressure from outside, Turkey was compelled to deal and to discuss this reality. And I told Hrant the following. I said that, Hrant, look, nobody listens to you in the normal time here in Turkey, but whenever there is an event in outside, a parliament resolution or something similar, they all come to you and they listen to you and they ask you questions only because of this pressure. Otherwise, they would never get interested in that topic. So my position today is the parliament resolutions are very crucial. They are very important. And we should not consider parliament resolution and Turkish civil society's activities as mutually exclusive. They don't reject each other. They don't exclusive. They support each other. We have to see that, and this is my position today, without Armenian diaspora's pressure from outside and without Turkish civil society, we cannot change the denial policy of Turkish government. We have to find a way of communication, a way of cooperation between Armenian diaspora and Turkish civil society. For this to happen, I think we need two things. One, Turkish civil society should stop considering diaspora as enemy or as others, as somebody who are pressuring something negative from outside. And also the Armenian diaspora should try to understand Turkish civil society in a sense that the democratization in Turkey is as important as the question of justice. You know what the main problem is? The main problem is the conflict between two major demands. the two major human necessity, let me put that way. One is liberty and freedom, and the other, justice. Turkish civil society fights today for liberty and freedom. Freedom of speech, more democratic rights, and more a democratic Turkey. But we know a more democratic country does not mean automatically that this country can establish the justice. You know, from Australia, until recently, Australia was always a democratic country, but justice never rectified or done here in this country until recently. So what diaspora is asking is justice. And because of this strong demand for justice, diaspora is a little bit reluctant to the question of freedom and liberty in Turkey. And on the other side, the Turkish civil society is not much so interested in last years in the question of justice. And this is now changing, and we have to work to change this, and we have to see we need both liberty, freedom, and justice. And these are not exclusive.
Professor Akcan, what's your views about the situation in Turkey? There are positive changes and they are visible. For example, there are people openly commemorating the Armenian genocide on April 24, even though the Turkish government's official stance hasn't changed and EU negotiations have stalled.
Yeah, this is the growing civil society in Turkey, as I mentioned. I have to add, of course, without changing the government policy, these commemorations were not possible in Istanbul because there are still extreme nationalists in Turkey as a product of 90 years of education and indoctrination. And the commemorations most in last year mostly happened under the police protection. So the government allows these commemorations. This is a sign of the democratization process in Turkey. It is not enough yet. It is not full-ended, but it is at least the beginning. And I think this commemoration will increase in the coming year. More and more Turks would discuss what happened in 1915. Government's policy won't change. I don't think that there will be a change in a very short period of time, not only because of the domestic political problems, I think especially because of the role of Azerbaijan. Turkey is not ready to change its policy because Turkey's and Azerbaijan's ties with each other in economic areas, for example, are so strong, and Turkey is a kind of hostage in the hand of Azerbaijan government, and I don't expect any change in coming years.
Professor Akcan, the main reasons Turkish government insists on in denying for almost a century the Armenian genocide, is it reparation, restitution, or there are any sort of deep-rooted problems?
I think there are more deep-rooted problems. One important reason, as you mentioned, is the question of reparation. Of course, Turkey doesn't want to pay any compensation for the Armenian losses because the entire Armenian wealth was confiscated by Ottoman government and it was distributed to Muslim immigrants. And today's Turkey, unfortunately, based on the plunder of Armenian wealth. And it is not easy for Turkish government to compensate these losses. I can understand this. I can understand in a way this might be one of the reasons. But I personally don't believe that the material aspect is so crucial. You know, there is an English saying, if there is a will, there is a way. If Turkish government wants to solve this problem, the question of compensation can be discussed between both societies and can be find a way. The basic rule is very simple, actually. You have to create the feeling among the Armenians saying that, okay, I'm now satisfied, and you have to create also among Turkish people also, yes, we are now satisfied because we rectified the Armenian losses and injustices. This is, I mean, whatever the amount of money or whatever the amount of the packages Turkey offers to Armenia for compensation, we have to see that it has a moral dimension and moral aspect. So I personally don't think that the material aspect is crucial. I mean, it is very important. I cannot deny this. But I think there are two other major problem, stumbling block on the way of recognition of Armenian genocide. One is very simple. If you lie 90 years, you cannot change this within 1 year. I think denialism turned into a character in Turkey. And if an individual lies really 90 years, you can hardly expect that this individual changed its position within a couple of days. This is one important aspect. And the second one is the problem of continuity. You know, the main problem that we face in recognition of Armenian genocide is that today's Turkey was established basically by the members of Union and Progress Party. Turkish Republic was established by the party that organized the Armenian genocide. So you have a continuity of a ruling, continuity of the ruling group, continuity of the ruling elite. This is the main problem. Why? Because every nation needs heroes. Every nation extols his founding fathers. And Turkey has also its founding fathers, and we are proud of being Turkish. We are proud of being with our founding fathers. And if we start openly discuss on Armenian genocide, we have to acknowledge, we have to face with the reality that an important number of our founding fathers, to whom really we admire, or the individuals that we extol, these individuals were either murderers or thieves. So it is very difficult for a nation to accept its founding fathers as murderers or thieves. Not the entirety, but an important number of its founding fathers. I think this has something to do with identity, with Turkish identity, and you can only talk about this past openly and clearly if you be able to develop a democratic identity. Only democratic societies can deal with their founding fathers in a democratic way, in a good way, because based on their democratic identity, our democratic identity, we can put this distance between ourselves and the crimes committed in the past in name of this nation. Australian society is an exact example for this, I think.
Professor Akçam, are you currently working on new projects or doing new research?
Yes, I'm working on different topics and different projects. In coming weeks, if not months, there will be a new book in Turkish out. It is on the confiscated properties. I analyze the laws and regulations related to confiscation of Armenian properties. And I'm still working on that topic because I discovered very important truths, realities that nobody knows. I give you only one example. During my research, I came across that based on Lausanne's agreement, Article 58, they established an international commission in Paris, 1923, to compensate the Allied powers' citizens for their losses during the First World War. So, according to Lausanne Agreement 58, Turkey agreed to compensate Allied citizens who were harmed by Ottoman government during the war year. And one of the articles that commission decided to compensate was the deportation of Armenians and killing of the Armenian families. And based on this decision, some Armenians of Great Britain citizen or French citizen were compensated by this commission for their loss of wives or families or for their materials, for their houses and for their properties also. It was an important discovery for me because it shows that compensation was an issue already 1923, and based on Lausanne Agreement, Turkey compensated already the loss of some Armenians who were citizens of Great Britain and France. So this means we have a very strong moral argument here for compensation also based on international law of the time.
Professor Akçam, it was a pleasure to talk to you and hope to see you tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what you think. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter.